Fighting believer, dug in their heels and stuck to their beliefs no matter how hard the task ahead. Abel Tasman, room number 143. You might have heard of Abel Tasman, the first European navigator to sight the island of Tasmania, but did you know he never set foot on the land that was eventually named after him? Tasmania was named after Dutchman Abel Janszoon Tasman, the first recorded European navigator to sight Tasmania. Ironically, Tasman did not step onto the land that was subsequently named after him. His journals dated 2nd of December 1642 give an insight as to the experiences of the visiting sailors. On Forestier's Peninsula, he wrote that, "We sent our pilot major Francois in command of our pinnace, manned with four musketeers and six rowers, together with the cockboat of the Zahane, with one of her second mates and six musketeers in it to obey. They heard certain human sounds, nearly resembling the music of a trump or a small gong, not far from them, though they had seen no one. The true inhabitants of the area were the Pidarumi band of the Oyster Bay tribe of Tasmanian Aborigines. They spent the winter months on the coast harvesting shellfish. During spring and summer, they moved up the east coast, then inland. Tasman named the land after his Dutch superior, Governor General Anthony van Diemen. The local inhabitants knew their land as Trorunna, Troena, or Lotrowitta. In his journal, Tasman recorded that while sailing the Heemskerk and Zeehane out of this bay and all through the day, we saw several columns of smoke ascend along the coast. So there can be no doubt there must be men here of extraordinary stature." Bishop Francis Russell Nixon, room number 105. Go with the grace of God as you say hello to Francis Russell Nixon, Tasmania's first Anglican bishop. Don't argue with him. The first Anglican bishop of Van Diemen's Land, Francis Russell Nixon, was born in Kent in 1803. After receiving a thorough education, he joined the Anglican ministry and served as clergyman in Naples, Italy. He then returned to England, continued serving the church, and was eventually appointed the first Bishop of Tasmania in 1842. He arrived in Hobart Town in 1843 and got to work separating the Tasmanian diocese from Sydney, proclaimed St. David's Church as a cathedral, and moved into Runnymede in Newtown. But things weren't all rosy. He soon began clashing with some of the locals over his traditional views. The governor, Sir John Early Wilmot, believed the government had jurisdiction over the clergymen of the colony, while Nixon believed the church did. The conflict went all the way to the Archbishop of Canterbury, who finally solved the problem by ordering a compromise. Nixon also publicly condemned the transportation of convicts, which angered many landholders who depended on convict labour. He also opposed the appointment of a Catholic bishop to the colony. Nixon travelled through the Furneaux Island group, meeting many Tasmanian Aborigines with whom he sympathised and tried to help. After 20 years of founding churches and tending his flock, he was exhausted, both physically and spiritually. Nixon went back to England in 1862 and then finally returned to Italy, where he died in 1879. Captain James Kelly, room number 246. Australian-born son James Kelly came to be known as the father and founder of whaling in Tasmania. An integral part of Tasmania's maritime history, Captain Kelly left his steps and his stamp on Tasmania and Hobart Town. Born in Parramatta, New South Wales in 1791, James Kelly was a smart and quick-witted child who advanced quickly along his chosen path, being apprenticed to shipping company Cable and Underwood in 1804 while still only 12 years old. In 1814, Kelly became the master of the Henrietta Packet, sailing between various ports of the colonies. He built a home in Hobart in 1815, an important year for Captain Kelly. While sailing with the Henrietta Packet, Port Davy was discovered on Tasmania's remote southwest. Captain Kelly and a small crew of convicts then sailed on in a whale boat and discovered Macquarie Harbour. Captain Kelly took on official duties from 1820 when Governor Lachlan Macquarie appointed him pilot and later harbour master of the Derwent River. In the 1830s, the new wharf opened where Salamanca Place now stands. Kelly owned a large area of land in Battery Point and built steps from the wharf up to his property. Kelly's steps were completed in 1840. Misfortune called on Kelly in 1831 when his wife Elizabeth died. Following this, the other mistress of his life, the sea, taxed him heavily. In 1834, his ship, Australian, was wrecked while another was lost to a Maori attack in New Zealand. In 1841, the sea claimed his eldest son, James, during a whaling expedition, and in 1842, his 17-year-old son, Thomas, drowned in the Derwent. The economic depression of the 1840s took its toll on Kelly's finances, and he returned to work for the Port Authority. Captain James Kelly died suddenly on the 20th of April 1859. Now resting in St. David's Park, he is remembered as a man who left his steps and his stamp on Hobart. Chiniqui's Visit, room number 215. Ever had trouble making up your mind? Charles P. Chiniqui certainly did. He went from being a Catholic priest to a Presbyterian minister overnight. He also nearly started a riot in Hobart Town. Some people just love trouble. Charles P. Chiniqui was born in Canada in 1809 and grew up to become a Catholic priest. But after witnessing corruption in the church, he converted to Presbyterianism and denounced Catholicism, an extremely controversial action. It made news all over the world and even prompted the United States president, none other than Abraham Lincoln, to publicly support him. Chiniqui went on a worldwide tour promoting his beliefs, which eventually took him to Hobart Town on the 23rd of June 1879, where he was set to deliver a speech in the town hall. The local Roman Catholic population denounced his visit and chose to attend his speech for the sole sake of opposing his views. Over 4,000 people attended the event, which quickly became heated, riotous, and uncontrollable. Soon, Chiniqui could not be heard above the roar of the crowd. The authorities became so concerned they ordered 500 troops to march from the Anglesey barracks down to the town hall to maintain civic order. By the time they arrived, Chiniqui was hiding behind the piano on the stage. Fortunately for him, the sight of the troops helped the crowd calm down. It is the only time in Tasmanian history that the military has been called upon to maintain order. Chiniqui left unharmed and never changed his views. He continued his war against Catholicism around the world and eventually died in Montreal in 1899. Critchley Parker, room number 231. After World War II, the State of Israel was created for the persecuted and exiled Jewish people of Europe. But what if they'd come to Southwest Tasmania instead? One man, Critchley Parker, tried to make it happen. Critchley Parker Jr., a sickly man from Victoria, had a vision that may have changed Tasmania dramatically. Born in 1911, he was an unhealthy and romantic youth who took to bushwalking to improve his constitution. However, it wasn't enough to get him strong enough for the military. He became enamored with journalist Carolyn Isaacson and, through her, became aware of the plight of the Jews in Eastern Europe. He also became interested in the Zionist movement and the efforts to find a new home for the displaced Jewish people. It occurred to Parker that the remote and rugged southwest region of Tasmania would be the perfect place to build a new Zion. He walked the area in 1941 with Dr. Isaac Steinberg, the leader of the Free Land League, and they both agreed it would be a good place for a new Jewish homeland. He returned alone in 1942 to further survey the region, but ran into trouble. The weather was terrible and Parker became terribly ill. He tried to signal for a ferryman to come to retrieve him from his camp, but it was too wet to light a fire. 3 weeks later, he died, and with him so did the dream of building a new home for the displaced Jewish people of Europe. His body was discovered 4 months later. He was buried at the foot of Mount Mackenzie, and these days there is a reserve near Upper Beaconsfield that bears his name. Doon Kennedy, room number 144. After an inauspicious childhood on a New South Wales sheep farm, Doon Kennedy ended up becoming the first female Lord Mayor of Hobart. Lorna Doon Pleasance Kennedy, née Brewer, was born in 1927 and raised on a New South Wales sheep farm. When World War II broke out, she left school to help support her family, finding employment in the Bank of New South Wales. At the age of 19, she was transferred to Hobart, where she met John Kennedy, a former prisoner of war who had been forced to work on the Thai-Burma Railway during the war. They married in 1949. John served as a Hobart City Alderman from 1970 until 1982, when Doon succeeded him. 4 years later, she was elected as Hobart's first female Lord Mayor on the back of a campaign focused on the beautification of the city and supporting local businesses. She went on to serve as Lord Mayor for 5 terms, retiring in 1996 after 10 years as a consistently popular and effective leader of the city. In 1994, she was appointed as an Officer of the Order of Australia. Her many achievements include city greenery programs, illuminating the trees at Salamanca, renovating Soundy Park, and spearheading the construction of the Hobart Aquatic Centre, which was later renamed in her honour. She died in 2014 at the age of 87 after a short illness. Eagle Hawk Escapades, room number 314. The hardest challenge for any convict sent to Port Arthur was escaping. To do that, they had to brave the dogs, guards, and sharks of Eagle Hawk Neck. Yet many tried and some succeeded. Port Arthur on the Tasman Peninsula was made escape-proof when an officer in charge, Ensign John Peyton Jones, established a line of dogs and lamps across the narrow isthmus at Eagle Hawk Neck. In 1842, Hardin Melville described the guard dogs as a motley bunch. Those out-of-the-way pretenders to dogship rejoiced in such sobriquets as Caesar, Pompey, Ajax, Achilles, Ugly Mug, Jowler, Tearum, and Muzzleum. Every four-footed, black-fanged individual among them would have taken first prize in his own class for ugliness and ferocity at any show. A convict handler was responsible for their care. To reinforce fear, the officers circulated the story that the seas around the Tasman Peninsula were infested with sharks and sea monsters. Undeterred, Martin Cash made plans with two fellow escapees to wade through the shallows of Eagle Hawk Bay at night. Taking all his clothes off and tying them in a bundle on his head, Martin Cash set off silently to swim to the other side. A breaking wave snatched his clothes away. He struggled ashore completely naked. Assuming that his mates had been taken by sharks, Martin was amazed to hear them whispering and that they also were completely naked. Their convict clothes had disappeared out to sea. The three made their way in the dark up the steep, rocky, thorn-covered hillside of Forestier Peninsula until they reached a convict road mender's hut. This they stormed, and the occupant found himself face to face with three naked bushrangers, one with an axe he had picked up on the way in. Alan Scott and the Flash Mob, room number 247. Some convicts sent to Tasmania put their heads down and tried to escape attention, but not Alan Scott and the Flash Mob. The majority of the female convicts transported to Van Diemen's Land had been arrested for petty theft and the crime of being desperately poor. They were exiled for life, 12,000 miles from their homeland, assigned to work for settlers for clothes, food, and lodging, which was supposed to reform them. Invariably, they were taken advantage of because became pregnant or accused of a crime and sent to the Cascade Female Factory for punishment. They could be put in a heavily spiked collar and placed in solitary confinement, have their hair cut off, or be forced to stand for 12-hour shifts in ankle-deep water, washing articles in stone wash tubs. In the 1830s, a lively and willful group of Cascade's female factory prisoners developed a distinctive subculture in defiance of this program of reform. Due to their distinctive attire, they were called the Flash Mob, and they rebelled by refusing to be slaves to the settlers. As a result, they were left to languish in crime class, where they distinguished themselves with a showy style of dress, sporting brightly coloured silk handkerchiefs, embroidered caps, rings, and fancy buttons. They danced, acted plays, and made up songs ridiculing the authorities. They were traffickers of contraband, power brokers who led riots, and predators who undoubtedly made life miserable for other prisoners. A myth regarding the origin of the flash mob, name developed due to an earlier charge against a likely flash mob member, Alan Scott. Arriving in Van Diemen's Land in 1830, Alan seemed unable to stay out of trouble. In 1833, the highly unpopular Reverend William Bedford, known by all as Holy Willie, was delivering a sermon at the Cascades Female Factory. Alan raised her skirt and slapped her naked posterior as the man of God teetered in shock before the highly amused congregation. Alan got an extra 2 months on her sentence for her trouble. It may have been worth it. Harold Gatty, room number 110. Never a man to let the grass grow under his feet, Harold Gatty was an aerial navigator and adventurer who not only lived in many locations around the globe, but also flew around it in 8 days. Born in Campbelltown, Tasmania in 1903, Harold Gatty's life as a citizen of the world saw his family move to Zeehan in Tasmania's remote west before continuing his schooling in Hobart and then the Royal Australian Naval College in New South Wales. After a brief time in New Zealand and Victoria, he returned to Sydney to operate a carrying service with a small launch vessel. Unfortunately, his launch sank. Undaunted, in 1927, he took his wife Vera and his young family to California to work as the chief mate on a schooner. By this time, his navigational knowledge was finely tuned and he moved into aerial navigation. He opened a workshop for repairing navigational equipment and making maps. Harold's work brought him to the attention of the Roscoe Turner, and in 1929, Harold navigated Turner's record-breaking 19-hour flight from Los Angeles to New York. The following year, in a flight from Japan to the US, Harold and Canadian airman Harold Bromley ran into fuel tank trouble and bad weather. With no radio, Harold navigated them safely through 1,200 miles. In 1931, he joined one-eyed stuntman Willie Post in flying the Winnie Mae, a Lockheed monoplane around the world in 8 days, 15 hours and 51 minutes, receiving a magnificent ticker tape parade in New York. Harold continued to live and work out of the US, but his work took him around the globe. During World War II, he was honorary group captain of the Royal Australian Air Force, and then, after the war, he bought the Fijian island of Katafanga, where he had a plantation, opened a tuna fishery, and founded Fiji Airways Ltd. A keen naturalist, Harold was writing a book on ocean currents and migratory patterns of birds when he died in 1957. His book was published posthumously in 1958 and described him as the foremost navigator of his time. Joseph Lyons, room number 125. You must have heard of Honest Joe, one of the most successful and popular politicians in Australian history and the first and only Tasmanian Prime Minister. Honest Joe Lyons was Premier of Tasmania before moving to federal parliament and rising to become one of Australia's most popular and long-serving prime ministers. He achieved the remarkable feat of becoming the first Australian prime minister to win and survive 3 consecutive federal elections, all the more remarkable for having happened during the Depression years of the 1930s. He was born in 1879 in Stanley in a settler's cottage below the Nut. His father, a descendant of Irish settlers, prospered in business until he ventured all his savings on the 1887 Melbourne Cup and lost the lot. Joe was set to work in menial occupations for low pay. These experiences left him with a sense of social justice and an abiding fear of instability. He joined the Workers' Political League, the early name for the Tasmanian Labour Party. In 1909, he was elected to the State Parliament as a Labour member and was given ministerial responsibilities, including education. 6 years later, he married Enid Burnell, a young woman with political ambitions, with whom he'd fallen hopelessly in love. Joe encouraged Enid to take part in politics. In 1925, they tramped the election trail. This was to be their political strategy thereafter, a somewhat chaotic family life amid political success. In that June 1925 state election, Joe, as Premier, not only had his wife standing as a candidate, but also his mother-in-law. Once elected Premier, his political career grew greater and greater. On the 6th of January 1932, he became Australia's 10th Prime Minister, the first and only PM from Tasmania. Linus Miller, room number 129. Join the fight with Linus Miller, patriot. A young Yank who wanted to stop his northern neighbours boot the Queen out of Canada, Linus was sent to Van Diemen's Land for his trouble. Down here, he suffered some torturous treatment while writing a journal that detailed the horror of convict life. A young, idealistic American law student, Linus Wilson Miller joined the Canadian rebels in 1838 in armed incursions to remove the British from Upper Canada. The Patriot cause failed and he was arrested near Niagara Falls. Linus, along with 91 other Canadians and American rebels, was banished to Van Diemen's Land. He arrived in Hobart Town on January the 12th, 1840. It is because of Linus Miller's memoir, Notes of an Exile to Van Diemen's Land, published in 1846, that abundant details of penal life are recorded. For 4 years, Linus was forced to undergo the same hard labour and harsh treatment as the English felons. He wrote that the Patriots worked in the wet, often without boots, dragging handcarts, carrying a ton of stone a distance of 2 miles, half of it uphill, to construct the Midlands Highway. They frequently collapsed, especially when their convict overseers appropriated their rations, which were then sold to the few prisoners who possessed money. The men slept in their wet clothes, had very little bedding and no fire. Anyone showing a spirit of resistance was flogged. Solitary confinement was the punishment for getting warm at the cookhouse fire. Eventually, Queen Victoria pardoned Linus and other Patriot prisoners between 1844 and 1850. Abandoned by the United States government, each man had to find his way home. Linus landed in the United States of America on the 25th of January 1846 to find his parents and siblings alive and well. Manalagina, room number 138. Deep lines of anguish and doubt must have etched the handsome face of Manalagina as he stood in the year 1835 on the deck of the government brig Tamar, looking upon the mountains of his homeland as they disappeared into the distance. When Manalagina sailed from his homeland, ahead of him were his daughters, his grandchildren, and a whole people whose future he had taken into his hands. One of the most feared and powerful leaders of Aboriginal tribes, Manalagina had found a guerrilla war of resistance against the British occupation of their lands. A man of undaunted courage and astonishing skills in battle, he was widely considered invincible. This unchallenged reputation enabled him to bring together many of the survivors of Tasmania's Black War and negotiate an end to the violence that threatened to destroy his people. Manalagina had strode through the alien terrain of British colonial politics, but he soon realized he had lost his gamble. The treaties he had agreed with the governor had been broken. The great chief died soon after arriving on Flinders Island, but his daughters and their children guaranteed that his legacy of fierce determination to see respect and justice for his people would survive. Today, many Tasmanian Aboriginal people speak Manalagina's name proudly as an esteemed ancestor. His belief in the survival of his people and the enduring strength of their culture ensured that the Aboriginal heritage of Tasmania will never be forgotten. Mark Jeffrey, room number 210. Is that the wind moaning or is it a ghost? Actually, it's just Mark Jeffrey come to rob your home while dressed as a ghost. But don't worry, his ghostly visage will pay him back one day when he's captured and sent to work as a gravedigger. As a 15-year-old in 1840, Mark Jeffrey left his Wood-Ditton, England home with his 12-year-old brother Luke because of repeated beatings from their father. They resorted to burglary to survive. In order to scare off anyone they might encounter, they dressed up as ghosts. After their 15th burglary, they were apprehended and sentenced to transportation. At Port Arthur, Mark spent long periods in solitary confinement, wearing leg irons, which eventually gave him a lot of pain and ulcers. In agony and furious at what he viewed as injustice, he smashed up his cell and then tried to murder the doctor. The authorities had him transferred to the Isle of the Dead to dig graves. He baked his own bread and occupied himself by making mats and brooms. If he required urgent attention, he lit a signal fire and a boat was dispatched to investigate. He reportedly lit the fire on several occasions, only to inform the arriving officers that he was out of matches. In 1889, he was transferred to the Invalid Depot at Launceston. By this time, he was able to enjoy some freedom as a gentle, contrite man and became locally well known as Big Mark, the Great English Burglar. Before he died, he wrote a book titled A Burglar's Life, a thrilling history of the dark days of convictism in Australia. It was published in 1893. Martin Cash, room number 304. Mr. Martin Cash certainly packed a lot of action into his life. Shooting a bloke in the bum, escaping Port Arthur, escaping a death sentence, working as a constable and writing an autobiography. A bushranger with a remarkable career, Martin Cash was transported to New South Wales in 1827 for shooting a man in the buttocks for kissing his girlfriend. He was given a ticket of leave and came with Bessie Clifford to Van Diemen's Land as settlers in 1837. Once here, he was sentenced to Port Arthur for stealing and repeatedly escaping. He escaped with two others, evading the dog line at Eagle Hawk Neck, and the three committed a series of robberies on well-to-do homesteads and mail coaches up to the year 1842. Their status as Cash and Co. grew amongst the lesser classes whom they left alone. In 1843, Cash was captured and sentenced to death for the murder of a constable. The sentence was commuted and he was sent to Norfolk Island. He behaved himself so well that he was made a constable and returned to Hobart in 1853 and appointed as a gardener at Government House. On receipt of a conditional pardon in 1856, he and his wife, ex-convict Mary Bennett, went to New Zealand for 4 years. Martin Cash died in 1877, considered a very old man at 69, having lived his last years on a small hop farm at Glenorchy. His 1870 autobiography, The Adventures of Martin Cash, ghost-written by convict James Lester Burke, gives a rather coloured version of the truth. Cash's Irish charm and cheerfulness and the chivalry and enterprise of his rebelliousness made him a popular scoundrel, which ensured that he enjoyed the goodwill of all his later years. Matthew Brady, room number 204. Say hello to Matthew Brady, convict, gentleman, bandit, and bushranger extraordinaire. After escaping from the Sarah Island penal settlement, he led a daring life of crime, bewildering the island's authorities and bewitching the island's women before surrendering to the law. Born in 1799, Matthew Brady was transported in 1820 for stealing a basket of bacon, butter, sugar, and rice. In 1823, he was sent to the Macquarie Harbour Penal Settlement, but escaped the following year and launched a short but memorable career as one of Australia's legendary bush rangers. When, in 1825, Brady and his gang attacked the Sorell Jail, surprised the soldiers cleaning their guns, locked them up in the cells, and freed the prisoners, it was just the latest exploit of this bold bandit. He was already famous throughout the colony for his dashing exploits, generosity towards the poor, and reluctance to use violence unless it was necessary. He was dubbed the Gentleman Bushranger because of his chivalrous behaviour towards women and his gentleness towards the weak. Others at the wrong end of his pistol, those whose belongings had been destroyed, burnt, or robbed by him, thought otherwise. Lieutenant Governor George Arthur offered a reward of 25 guineas to any settler or a conditional pardon to any convict who could capture or apprehend Brady. Brady responded to the price on his head by posting his own notice 3 days later, offering 20 gallons of rum to anyone who could capture Lieutenant Governor Arthur. But his life on the run couldn't last forever, and in 1826, Brady was eventually wounded in a skirmish after being betrayed by some of his gang members and captured. While lying in a cell in Hobart, he was overwhelmed with presents, baskets of fruit, bouquets of flowers, and confectionery. His cell was packed with visitors, even Lieutenant Governor Arthur called on him. Petitions for clemency, particularly from women, were delivered to the authorities but failed to save Brady from the fate that awaited captured bushrangers during the 1820s, the noose. Mother One-Eyed Brown. Ever wanted a willow washing pad? Mother One-Eyed Brown made the best in the land, and she didn't give you much choice about buying them. Room number 115. Thought to have been named Mary Mother One-Eyed Brown was an itinerant tinker who travelled Tasmania from end to end, hawking household items such as pots and pans, tin cups, kettles, and sundry other items. Of all the items she sold, she is most remembered for her handmade willow clothes pegs. Depending on the town or region she was passing through, Mrs. Brown was also known by such epithets as Mother Brown, Ma Brown, Bungay Brown, Peg Brown, and the Tin Lady. Described as an unkempt woman of indeterminate age, she would arrive with a clatter of pots and tins in her cart, drawn by a mangy horse, usually accompanied by an entourage of several dogs. Stories of her temper have her throwing a bucket of water over a butcher for denying her free meat, letting someone's dog out for refusing to answer the door, smacking children for staring out the windows, and frightening others into filling her billy can with milk. Although children and many adults were frightened of the intimidating figure that Mrs. Brown cut, she is sometimes reported to have been in the company of a few children. It is thought she may have had four of her own, and a son, Joe, is also remembered by some folk in the Midlands. Although Mrs. Brown has left no paper trail of her life, her handmade willow pegs are still discussed across the island and are now to be found in museums in Tasmania and the mainland. Lord help you if you didn't buy them. Piping Lane, room number 220. And we're off and racing with Piping Lane, a runt of a foal that never gave up, eventually becoming the first Tasmanian horse to win the Melbourne Cup. The 1972 Melbourne Cup is remembered by Tasmanians as the day the locally bred and owned galloper, Piping Lane, took on Australia's top horses and beat them over the newly changed metric distance of 3,200 metres, previously 2 miles. As a foal, Piping Lane was so small he was compared with a Great Dane. Given time to mature, Piping Lane was sold for $100 only because the buyer figured he was a yearling and not a 2-year-old. In April 1972, a 69-year-old tallow merchant, licensed amateur jockey and owner-trainer from Devonport named Ray Trinder spotted the unremarkable-looking galloper's staying power and purchased him for $6,000. With the specific aim of winning the Melbourne Cup, Trinder exercised Piping Lane through the winter and later travelled to Hobart regularly to supervise his training right up until the big race. Piping Lane was allotted 48 kilos in the Cup. Many top jockeys were unable to ride it this way, so John Letts, a jockey who had never ridden the course at Flemington before, took to the saddle. When asked about his chances of winning, he replied, "We're only here to make up numbers." Sure enough, Letts and Piping started at odds of 40-1 before surging home to take the victory, and a bad result for Tasmanian bookmakers. Ever supportive of their own, even animals, most Tasmanians backed Piping Lane, even if just a token 50 cent each way bet. Rodney Croom, room number 309. Meet Mr. Rodney Croom, a tireless campaigner for equality, social justice, and one of Tasmania's modern heroes. He is perhaps best known for being named Tasmania's Australian of the Year for the exact same actions that once saw him thrown in jail. Rodney Croom grew up on a dairy farm on the northwest coast and studied European history at the University of Tasmania. When he came out as gay, his heterosexual friends urged him to flee to a mainland city. Instead, he helped found the Tasmanian Gay Law Reform Group, which set up a small stall in Hobart's Saturday Salamanca Market in September 1988, asking market-goers to sign a petition to support decriminalising homosexuality. The Hobart City Council banned the stall, but the group refused to budge. Over 7 successive Saturdays, 130 people, including Rodney, were arrested, while hundreds more gathered to protest the council's discrimination and repression. 9 years later, after a high-profile campaign involving the United Nations, the federal government and the High Court, the Tasmanian laws were repealed and were replaced with some of the fairest human rights laws in Australia. Symbolic of this transformation was an apology for the arrest by Hobart City Council in 1988, the first of its kind in Australia. In 2004, Rodney founded Australian Marriage Equality and has been one of Australia's leading proponents of the reform. In 2015, Rodney was named Tasmanian's Australian of the Year for his tireless work in promoting equality, the very same actions that saw him thrown in jail 27 years earlier. Trakanini, room number 227. One of the most famous figures in Tasmania's Black War, Trakanini was the daughter of a chief. She was also an ambassador, a warrior, and a figure of inspiration for generations to come. Born in 1812, Trakanini entered a world of great change. Her father, Mangurna, was leader of the Nguyen tribe, who had witnessed the arrival of British settlers less than 10 years earlier. It was at a whaling camp on Bruny Island that regular contact between the Nguyen and British began. At first, this was peaceful, but soon these settlers began to attack Aborigines, stealing their daughters and forcing them from their traditional lands. This was the beginning of Tasmania's Black War, and Trakanini was to become one of its most famous figures. In 1829, Trakanini met George Augustus Robinson, who had been commissioned by the governor to establish a mission to provide Aborigines with protection against these aggressions. Her skills in diplomacy and the many indigenous languages of Tasmania made this mission possible. Trakanini guided Robinson around Tasmania. He offered promises and treaties to convince Aborigines resisting British invasion to leave their land for the safety of a mission on Flinders Island. These promises were never honoured, and instead of a place of safety, Flinders Island became a prison. In 1835, Trakanini was taken by Robinson to Victoria, where he tried to conduct the same process. Instead of helping Robinson, Trakanini joined with local Aborigines in an armed guerrilla campaign. After a number of settlers were killed, Trakanini was arrested and narrowly escaped being hanged in Melbourne in 1842. Trakanini died in 1876, establishing a reputation for herself as an ambassador and a warrior. Her life inspires Tasmanian Aborigines today to keep their culture strong and maintain their rights to land. Vic Garth, room number 245. Listen up, or not. It won't really matter, because when Hobart's famous town crier Vic Garth is ringing his bell, you can't help but hear him. For over two decades, Victor Joseph Garth was a town treasurer as the Hobart town crier. Until his passing at 92 years of age in 2005, Vic was possibly the most photographed, recognised and respected figure in the city. Despite failing health, Vic, as the voluntary town crier, made it his business to attend as many weekly Salamanca markets as possible, greet visitors disembarking from cruise ships in Hobart, visit the children's ward at the local hospital, take part in Christmas pageants and festivals, and support numerous charities. Ringing a big brass handbell, as town criers have always done, Vic would simultaneously shout the words, "Oh yes, oh yes, oh yes," which also means, "Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye," to draw attention to public events. Vic was chaplain of the Ancient and Honourable Australian Town Criers Guild, founded in 1989. The Vic Garth Memorial Award celebrates his talent and reputations as having been the oldest working, most skilled and experienced town crier in the world. When asked the key to his success, Vic said, "It is to stay alive." Brother Garth and his family were members of the Glenorchy Ward of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. 3 years before his passing, he positioned a letter to his children for them to find when he had passed over. In the letter, he wrote the following: "No father could be prouder of his sons and daughters. Think big, don't be afraid to aim higher in life, and most importantly, thank God for every blessing, every day and every night."